Welcome to the Legal Cheek podcast, and today's episode is the start of a new series that we're doing about the history of the legal profession. And today we're going to be focusing on corporate law in the 1980s. And with me, my guest is Alan Paul, who is a former corporate lawyer and partner at Allen & Overy. And Alan, you began your career in 1978, I believe.
Yes, I did. And thanks very much for inviting me to come.
Thanks for coming. Great to see you.
Should I tell you a little bit about my background?
That would be great. Yeah. You summarise your career journey really from law student at, was it Oxford University?
Yes, I was there for a few years, and I actually changed to law because fundamental reason was I knew nothing about what lawyering was, but I wanted a job when I left. So I changed to law halfway through my course. So I did that. I'm now a self-employed advisor, really, on M&A and that sort of thing, which I did when I was at A&O. That was my main work. And I'm a professional business coach for partners in city law firms. So that's what I do now. I was a partner at A&O from 1985.
So you made partner quite early then. So if you've trainee, started 78, finished your training contract in 1980.
It was different then.
Partner by 85, wow.
Yeah, there was a lot, of course, that was different then. But I think partners were people became partners, particularly in the 80s, because that was a big time for growth of the law firms in the city, became a lot younger than they do now, which I know is sort of up to 8, 9, whatever, or more years of
that just
PQE.
Was, like, fewer lawyers back then in these firms, or so more opportunities?
Well, there were certainly fewer lawyers, that's absolutely correct, but it was such a period of growth, and the world's all about right place, right time, if you like, and I happened to be in the right place at the right time because it was when my firm made up, in the year I was made up, and you must remember there were only about 50 partners or whatever then, they made up 18 partners in that year, which is slightly bizarre. They'd never done anything like that. So lucky me and lucky the others.
So by 85, you're in as your partner. And what happens? What happens then?
Well, I suppose what happens then is that it's a pretty terrifying moment, just like it's a terrifying moment when you first qualify, because you don't really know what to expect.
Were you still in your 20s at this point then?
No, I was, how old was I? I'd have been 31, I think.
Okay.
31, yeah.
Pretty young though, partner at a Magic Circle law firm.
Yeah, of course, it wasn't a Magic Circle law firm then, it was just a domestic
corporate
law firm.
They coined that term, which is something we're going to come on to in a bit. But
yeah.
Anyway, sorry, Alan, keep going.
No, and so I was a trainee, article clerk then, they called them, a trainee from 78, and I was lucky enough to get a job. In fact, I know when I remember going for the interview because I stood outside Allen Overy's offices in Cheapside, but I didn't know I had arrived because there was no obvious sign that this was a law firm. It was just a door between a wine bar called Ball's Brothers and a bank, and I sat in the courtyard of the wine bar thinking, where the hell's this office? Anyway, you went in, you had half an hour interview, and that was it.
Wow. Contrast that with the recruitment processes.
And now,
these
of course,
days.
It's entirely, and it has been for many, many years, an entirely different, much more rigorous, you might say, process.
Also, if you go to Allen & Overy's office now, there's no shortage of signage around.
No.
It always feels like a kind of airport to me, the current A&O office. It's almost like.
Yeah, it's quite a big sort of. It's. I suppose you wouldn't call it an atrium, but the main entrance is. Yeah, it's quite a.
But it was just a door between
a couple
of other doors.
Wine between bar. These places. And I sat there and sat there and I thought, where is this place? And eventually I sort of got in there. I'd never been to the city before other than to go to St. Paul's Cathedral. So I really was a novice. So that was becoming a trainee. And then I qualified as solicitor in 1980. And after that, just carried on doing corporate law. At A&O, so it was nice to have my whole career there. I loved it.
So you starting in the late 70s, and I think that was just as the winter of discontent was getting underway with widespread strikes. I mean, those strikes back then, were they worse than the strikes we're seeing at the moment?
Worse. I think people would say they were, yes. I mean, the consequences were worse. These days, I don't think the consequences, of course, for children in schools, etc., is not great, but the consequences across the your lifestyle generally, no, they're nothing like what they were then.
Those strikes.
I don't think, yeah.
Yeah, because they were the bin men strikes, weren't they?
They had everybody. I mean, there were all sorts of people.
Wow.
All sorts of people were striking. In the 70s,
yeah.
And the big one in the 80s, of course, was the miners' strike, which after when Margaret Thatcher, like her or not, did what she did, yeah.
So Thatcher came in as Prime Minister around that, I think, 79.
Yep.
And then you qualified in 1980. And, you know, very, very city and the corporate legal market, very different worlds to what they are today. You really starting your career at quite a low point for the country, really. Must have been pretty gloomy. But then things kind of changed. But just tell us about starting out at that point.
Okay, I mean, if I could perhaps just set a bit of a context, because of course so much then was very different to what it is now. Obviously there were no huge firms, we were domestic corporate firms with finance or whatever else, but it was corporate and finance were the things.
And mainly domestic work.
Mainly domestic. I mean, yeah. There was international work, particularly in finance, and there would have been incoming M&A work. But generally, most work was domestic corporate, I would call it. There were no US law firms doing UK law. That was not an issue. So there were probably about 20 firms
in the city
who were much of similar reputations with, in fairness, probably Linklater and Slaughter and May, the most well-known, because they had been established for hundreds of years, like Freshfields too.
Yeah.
A&O was a very young firm, and Clifford Chance didn't exist in the early 80s. So, but there are a lot of other firms, some of which still exist,
yeah,
but most of which have fundamentally changed their spots or merged with somebody else.
Mm.
And, you know, no point in naming all of them. And there was no... and the firms themselves, there was no sort of real... internal internet communication. Obviously there was nothing like that, no cell phones,
yeah,
and there was no multiple career path. I mean, today of course you've got in-house law, you've got, yeah, all sorts of roles.
So there was no in-house lawyers then?
Well, there were a few, yeah, but it wasn't regarded as, it just wasn't something people aspired to.
Okay.
Whereas now it's a fantastic role. I mean, and that's been so for many, many years.
But so these companies had much smaller legal teams?
Yeah, much smaller, yeah. Much smaller.
Okay.
And so most people in firms like A&O were hoping that maybe partner was their career path.
Right.
And of course it wasn't to be for everybody, but if it wasn't at that firm,
yeah,
maybe it would be another firm that does similar work, but perhaps at a... was a bit smaller. But
so there was some movement between the firms?
Well, at the associate level.
Okay.
Because, yeah, associates moved because if they weren't going to make partner, they went somewhere else.
Right.
But not really between partners, no.
And right, the term magic circle didn't exist
then.
No,
that was...
But I suppose it seems like there was an informal grouping of leading firms. I mean, you mentioned Linklaters and Freshfields as kind of venerable...
Yeah, and Slaughter and May, I would say those were the three most venerable, yeah, then. Of course, now they're, whilst they're very venerable, so there are a lot of other firms that are very venerable too. So it's a very different scenario. And the 40 years since have seen, of course, massive changes. But apart from technology, leaving that aside, I think there are a lot of common features in the nature of lawyering, if you like. But the first one I'd mention was that then, and ever since, you know, London has been a top financial centre and probably the top for international business, international finance. It was then, is now. An English language, of course, has become dominant in commercial world globally.
Mm.
And English law an English reliability in law, at least, is something that has meant that international transactions are done under English law far more than and US law, but those are the two. Okay. So what an advantage that is, and it's still an advantage.
But back then, though, it wasn't that international.
No, but not yet.
But it was starting.
It was still English law under, particularly in finance, was a really big thing. Yeah. Mm.
And yeah. It's interesting because, I mean, just on a slight tangent, because you hear it, you read a lot of gloomy stories in the newspapers about London losing its crown and this and that. But you're not convinced by that. You still think it's the leading.
Well,
it's
certainly a leading. Yeah. For some things, it is the leading in finance, and that's what the city is about, finance. And right through that period of, I guess, 40 years, it's had its challenges, but it's always adapted to those challenges. And I think if it goes on doing so, it can maintain its top position. And I'm an optimist, so I hope it does.
So you're training at A&O in the late 70s. You're commuting in through the strikes. Do you remember where you were living at that point, or?
Yeah, I was living in North London. Yeah, I lived in Harrow.
So travelling down from there, was that with family or friends or?
No, on my own. Yeah. Sorry, yeah. If you see what I mean. I was travelling, but on the Met Line, yeah. So as it was then.
Hasn't
changed much.
Yeah, same line, coming down into the city. And was it seen sort of among your peers from uni and stuff that you'd landed this kind of really high status job, as it would be today, golden ticket, trainee at a Magic Circle law firm?
I don't really know, but I don't think so. I never felt that. I mean, I think, you know, people were all doing different things. Quite a few to go into law, but I think you had the same respect for everybody, whatever job they were doing. I mean, I don't think we thought of things quite like. Well, I didn't. I mean, didn't think of it like that.
Yeah.
But the one thing certainly that there was in common then with lawyering today, you know, you had to get into it being a service industry. You're about clients' needs. That's what it's all about. It was then, and it is now. And just like now, it's. Like all challenging jobs, it was hard work.
Yeah,
And you had to enjoy it. If you didn't enjoy it, then you needed to give it up.
Yeah, and you've presumably found that you enjoyed it pretty pretty quickly.
Yeah, I think largely due to, I did enjoy it. Once it got going as an associate, particularly because of the variety and the people involved, people in the firm, people, clients, meeting them, and you were learning so much. Mm. Every day, which is what happens right through your legal career, really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, and then, you know, as the decade progressed, so it's clear that you started your career at a low point, and there were some big events happening that were changing the country.
Yep.
And by extension, the city of London. Tell us a bit about that.
Okay. Remember. Just a few sort of facts of background as to what the world was like in the 80s. Of course, there was the Cold War still going on. That, of course, there's a new Cold War now. And that was going on until 1989 when the Berlin Wall fell, which was a moment of new opportunities, of course. We had the Falklands War, had Russians' War in Afghanistan.
Falklands War, was it?
Yeah, I think it was 82, somewhere it was around there.
Yeah.
And then the Russians were in Afghanistan, got kicked out in 88, I think. And we had a lot of London bombs, which was not great news, and around the country.
IRA bombs.
Yeah, sadly. Miners' strike, you know, the famines in the world. You might think things weren't that different to the way what's going on today. And the inflation rate, for example. Take the inflation rate, it was in 1980, I looked this up, it was 18%.
Okay.
And in around that time, interest rates were about 17%.
Right, God.
And while they went down, I think, to about 10 by the end of the 80s, something like that.
So not a good time to have a mortgage.
No, it wasn't a great time. It just, everything, you, you just had to try and manage it. I mean, it wasn't it was bad news when as interest rates went up. They came down eventually, so. But you didn't have those massive mortgages you have today. There was limits that banks would lend.
So that contrasts with the inflation rate today, I think 10.4% or thereabouts.
Yeah.
So, God, 17%. And so were you kind of getting regular pay rises, presumably?
Good God, no.
No?
Nothing's changed. No, we didn't get regular pay rises.
And I suppose that's one of the different things as well is sort of the salaries for trainee corporate lawyers then and indeed junior associates were a lot lower than they are now, kind of relative to other career paths, whereas now, I mean, some of these figures, they're going in at well in excess of 100,000 as newly qualified.
So I'm told.
Whereas back then it wasn't that much out of line with kind of teacher doctor.
No, figures. And it was definitely better if you were going into the city to go into a bank or other financial industry type things. But you didn't. I don't know. I think at the time. I think we're all pleased to have a decent, good job in a good place, and I don't think you sort of money wasn't the key driver, I would say it should never be your absolute key driver for your work decision, but that's another matter. Yeah.
So in the early days of the Thatcher government.
Yeah, and of course a lot of interesting things happened. Is it worth saying what it was like about just actually as a lawyer, as a corporate lawyer, what you had to do and that sort of thing?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. The experience of new solicitors obviously varied, and the thing it varied with most was of course, who you worked for, like partners. You were really assigned to one, two, three partners. And there wasn't the high leverage of ratio of solicitors to partner then. It would tend to be a bit more one-to-one-ish, as opposed to, say, three-to-one-ish now, whatever it is.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
So that was a very different thing. And and there wasn't the training. Now most of the firms have these big training courses and for young lawyers, which I think is fantastic, and it's not just in the law. I think that's great. But you didn't have really any of that then.
But then I suppose you didn't need it so much if you just had one-on-one with your supervisor.
Well, I think that's the thing. You were talking to them all the time, and you were they were supposed to check your work quite critically. And some were more critical and brutal than others, of course, like today. And so you did learn very much from on the job. And you probably spent more time in the library, which is now on your laptop, as opposed to you had to go walk there. So you did more of that sort of research. And actually, if you did a deal, and let's say most of it was private deals, not public, the documentation was much simpler. Everything was much shorter. Everything was less complicated, is the truth. And you, as a corporate lawyer, we're expected to know a little bit about everything. You didn't go running off to specialists all the time, which typically you do now, which is quite right now. But then you sort of muddled through on employment law and a bit of tax and a bit of this.
You just do a bit of research for yourself
in
the library.
You knew some basics, and then when you got really sensitive, it was getting a bit difficult. There was always somebody you could ask. But it meant you did a lot more, I found, you did a lot more yourself. Like if on a transaction, you'd probably do the due diligence all by yourself. You wouldn't have an army of people, but then the transactions were less complicated.
So. And this would be as an associate.
Yeah,
and you just so probably a lot of grunt work then.
Huge amount of grunt work.
And just working through it.
Yeah,
by yourself.
And you not only had to do the grunt work, it didn't have the support. You had support systems, printing and typing and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But you didn't have it all night. So you had to know how to operate all the printers, how to bind documents and then pack your documents.
Okay.
And then arrange the courier.
Okay.
You couldn't send it on the laptop, and you sort of had to do all that yourself, and you couldn't find somebody else to take it, you had to deliver it by hand. So it's a bit different.
I suppose good training, getting to know how all the different aspects of the business work. And so in terms of, you know, out of hours stuff, is that the same kind of culture of, as often late nights?
There were late nights when there were late nights. You didn't, not as much as now, I think. No, definitely not as much as now. In fact, I'm sure we found more time to go to the pub at 6 o'clock than people do today.
Yeah.
But there was plenty. I can remember certainly a period, a week on a transaction, probably when I was 4 years qualified or something. And I know I didn't go home for more than about 12 hours in the week.
Okay.
And that's at an extreme. But yeah, lots of people had their moments, but it wasn't like that all the time.
Yeah.
So you had to work hard just like you do now, but it was very different pressures, I suspect.
Okay. And so wasn't it, were you working with other associates then, or was it quite separate?
To a certain amount, but you didn't have that, there was sort of pyramid. It was more, if you can call it a pyramid, people like to call it a pyramid, which I think is changing quite a bit now, but it wasn't, it was a bit more like a trapezium.
Okay.
And it was, which is that one where you have two parallel lines, but no top on it.
Yeah.
And it was a bit more like that, and if you were on a job, typically your partner knew what was going on, but it was you, and if you had a trainee, it was a trainee, but if you didn't, then it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. There wasn't a ladder of associates, or not that many. Typically, I mean, obviously some things required more people.
Yeah. So partner, associate, trainee, kind of working in these little teams.
Yeah.
And now, how does that compare? Is it sort of much bigger grouping?
Well, I think that in the major city firms, if there are small jobs, that's what has to be, even to make it economic to do the work.
Yeah.
It's probably associate only, which is why they don't really want to do small work most of the time.
Okay.
And as the firms have developed commercially, and so they've had to focus on different work because only certain work pays.
Yeah.
And the way law firms run, you only want to do profitable work, really.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's a change, a big change. But there's still a lot in common about the type of work you were doing.
But I suppose, like, back then with, you know, the kind of Thatcher government and things like privatisations of industries and stuff.
Yeah.
So you'd started in this real low point, and then you had these kind of Allen and Overy and other firms growing to handle this kind of new work in the 80s that hadn't been done before.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the 80s brought, at the end of the 70s, I suppose, exchange controls. When exchange controls were where you couldn't take money out of the country, it was terrible when you were going on holiday because you could only take a limited amount of foreign currency or in sterling. It was quite limiting.
Okay,
so
okay.
And that liberation
bank
was great.
Cards.
No.
Travellers' checks.
Yeah, travellers' checks. But for business, it meant that money coming in, money going out was now deregulated and no controls.
That's a massive change.
Yeah, though. And so this whole department, which was part of the Bank of England, based in Cheapside, where Allen and Overy had its office in their building, when they all left, I don't know if they were retired or whatever, but they left, which meant the office could expand and stay in the same place, which I thought was perhaps a bonus.
So these were kind of the currency control people, and they got replaced by lawyers from expanding.
Well, we did. They just left, and I think the rest of the building was sublet by A&O. So, and other firms will do experience similar changes. There were, I think you mentioned the privatisation, for example, and here this is a good example of how the law firm model, the big law firm model, was changing, because privatisations like the gas, British Gas, Telecom, BT, electricity companies, water companies, the railways, these were in the 80s and early 90s, these were hugely intensive in terms of the amount of people you needed to throw bodies at it, which arguably is not a great use of highly qualified lawyers, but there was so much due diligence to do and reconstruction and this, that and the other, that these were jobs that people, law firms, if they got them, knew they, sorry, had an annuity for a few years of lots of people busy.
Mm.
And hence you could build, you know, this is when you started to leverage the firm. Those were classic first examples, I think, of how firms used, you know, lots of people on big matters. Privatisation was a classic.
So these were like basically like massive matters coming in, like privatising a utility.
Well, can you imagine? Yes,
like huge.
The gas. I mean, you know, you can tell how big that must have been. British Gas. It was only one, so it was the whole of the country.
And did that like just go to one law firm? Got the whole lot, or was it?
I don't honestly remember, but I think there would have been a lead law firm for the company to be formed, and there would have been a lead law firm for the government, and there would have been lots of firms doing lots of other different things.
Okay,
I was fortunate. I regard myself in the sense I never did any of that work other than selling off smaller parts of stuff that was owned by government. The reason I think I was lucky was these things lasted years and actually were very wearing on people. Any job that lasts for years, especially if you're a young lawyer, pretty stressful in the sense of you're doing the same thing for months and months and months.
Because you hear about some things, like I heard a couple of years ago, like a law firm still has got several lawyers working on the Lehman bankruptcy from 2008.
Probably. I bet they're not the same lawyers, but because it's killing. I mean, it really is, that sort of stuff.
But in a broader sense, it's good for business, for the likes of Allen & Overy, because you've got all this activity going on. I mean, this exchange currency controls, that seems strange now, but... So that must have led to just loads of money just flooding into the city.
Yeah.
And that creating loads of...
I think exchange controls was a very big... And, of course, money going out, which meant investment internationally was so much easier. And you know, that meant, of course, more law firm work. It's quite an interesting statistic is that I think that in 1980, what they call cross-border assets, if you like, here in the Flint City, was something like, I looked this up, $300 billion in 1980, and that's still a lot of money.
Yeah.
But by the end of by 2020, it's a long time on, it was $5 trillion.
God.
So you're talking about 16 times what it was. And so that's all a period of growth. You know, it illustrates growth to me. I mean, you know, I'm not saying bringing lots of work, but it illustrates growth in a massive way.
Okay, and then you had, like, you know, so you had these privatizations and other deregulation, but then 1986 was a big year because that was big bang.
Yeah, there were other things perhaps we should touch on, but let's talk
about. Oh no, if you want to touch on the other things first.
Well, the big bang was the biggest thing in the 80s from I think the city's change.
Yeah.
But other things that started were things like, you'll hear now, private equity now is a very big area of work for, and it's, you know, it's how the US law firms become big in the city, really, is private equity. But that started in the 80s, really. Before that, it was venture capital.
Right.
But private equity began with what you call leveraged buyouts. Is it worth explaining what a leveraged buyout is?
Yeah, definitely.
Do you think people would know?
No, I think it's worth a quick explainer.
Okay. It's very... these are where people, a group was selling off, say, a business, which it didn't want, it wasn't mainstream, and instead of it just being sold to a competitor, the management of that company thought, oh, well, we could buy this if we can raise the money. And what happened was that money became available through what we call now private equity houses, I'm not sure we called them that then.
Mm.
And the way they would put up, say, a tenth of the purchase price, or a fifth, depending, and the rest would be borrowed. Mm-hmm. To buy the company, and these are called leveraged transactions, and they were management buyouts because they were management led.
Yeah,
private equity has switched that around eventually, and they just do it themselves, and you don't need management. And a leveraged transaction in M&A is like buying a house, if you like. If you buy a house, you borrow a load of money, you put your own money in, but as prices go up, the debt stays the same, and your value of your equity goes up and up and up, in theory, if you're lucky.
Yeah, most
and, of course, the value of the debt goes down because of inflation. So, in a way, that's all a leveraged transaction. It's like buying a house.
Okay.
And you have to mortgage your house.
But you get a much bigger upside.
If you sell at the right time.
Yeah.
And yeah. it's exactly the same with a leveraged buyout. Okay. If they sell at the right time, they make a lot of money. If they wait or markets go against them, then they hang on to it for too long, it starts to be less money.
So before then, had debt not been used in this way to make acquisitions?
No, because the debt, big acquisitions were really made by corporates, not by fund managers, basically, which is all private equity people are. They're fund managers. Yeah, this was fairly new. Before that, it was the equivalent were venture capital and development capital, all quite small. All quite small, but real work. And I used to do quite a lot of that. But now, this was now private equity becoming very, and by the 90s, it was a real growth industry.
And so it was a kind of financial innovation, essentially, that came in, and being new, it needed lawyers to make sure it was secure.
Yeah, well, what is wonderful about it, it's a bit like the privatisations, it's not just an acquisition, it's all the due diligence, which meant lots of lawyers again, whether that's sensible or not. And today that's being watered down, I think. It meant, not just a corporate lawyer, it meant all the finance lawyers have to be in a very big way.
Right. And that's where you came in.
Well, I was the corporate guy, but the finance borrowing people, the debt people.
Okay.
And it was, so it brought in everybody from the firm.
Yeah.
And whichever firm you happen to be in. And of course, if it was an international business, it brought in a whole stream of international lawyers, you know, who were in different countries.
Right.
And at that time, in the 80s, people didn't tend to have their own local lawyers in their firm. They might have an office, but it would tend to be a rep office more. And so there was work for, and then in the 90s, which will come another time maybe, firms expanded into all these other countries, and so that sort of deal meant work for their own people in all these other countries. So it was like the privatization. These things were employed huge amounts of lawyers.
So it was this that was kind of put the seeds in the ground that enabled law firms to become international in the future.
Part of the expansion. Yeah. And, you know, finance was very big in that. But there are other things like Canary Wharf. There's the creation of the futures market, what we call LIFFE, LIFFE.
Yeah.
All sorts of things like that. But you mentioned Big Bang.
Yeah. Just quickly, though, before we get onto that. So would you, what area would you say was kind of defined you as a kind of rising associate to partner? What?
Well, I did a great mix of things. It was probably mostly in private transactions. I hardly did any public work, whereas when I became partner, public work was my big thing.
Mm-hmm. That's publicly listed companies.
Yes. Yeah. And I was doing this initial private equity work, because Bankers Trust, it was the main driving force from America creating this new industry.
Yeah.
And we worked for them. And so that was one area. But otherwise, I just got on with my job and, you know, got lucky. So,
But the leverage buyouts was a big thing for you.
It was something I started doing, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
And so that must have been quite exciting at the time. So it was this sort of, you know, you've got into law, you're enjoying it, you've got this financial innovation that's come along, you're doing a lot of it. And it's kind of, you know, right time, right place in some ways.
Again, I think so. No, I was lucky to be doing that stuff.
So that kind of, you kind of ride that wave up to partnership at the firm.
Yeah.
And then, you know, 86, so your partner 85, and then 86, this famous Big Bang. What happened there?
Well, what happened with Big Bang, and funnily enough, I was sent off in 85. I was sent away from the firm. I became a partner. I was sent to be seconded at the takeover panel, which is where I learned about public work. So I was away for those 2 years, but it had a big impact on the takeover world as well. So what happened in 86 was the, what do you call it? I think it was a termination of what they call fixed commission trading, but that's a bit of a technicality, I think, for this purpose. Big thing happened was the Stock Exchange, London Stock Exchange, which was a privately owned thing, owned by the brokers, basically, about 300 members, something like that, was now made open for foreign, non-UK people to buy. Anybody could buy into the exchange, which meant that the people, the members of the exchange, now started selling their shares.
Right, so it was became publicly listed?
No, they just sold them to private, to banks, for example. And the brokers could now work, a stock broker is just an agent. But the actual trading of shares was done by what they call jobbers. Today they call them market makers. And they had to be separate by law. And that was dropped.
Right.
So now they could, a bank, not an American bank couldn't buy them for American reasons, but a foreign bank like UBS, Union Bank of Switzerland, as it was, they could buy a broker. So the brokers, this was the opportunity for the brokers, which were partnerships, to sell, and they were all selling. And that created then what was the old merchant banks. They weren't what we called investment banks today. They just used their own money just to buy and sell things. They bought brokers and they bought jobbers. And so instead of just being advisors and acquirers, they now became traders. And so the securities industry was thrown up in the air. And some people call it deregulation, which is correct, but in another sense it was more regulation, because there was this Financial Services Act, creation of the Securities Investment Board, which is now the Financial Conduct Authority, and this created a whole new raft of rules and law. And it was the arrival of compliance officers and compliance in the finance industry, now, which is largely lawyers. And then I think it was the start of the big legal departments in the financial industry, much bigger legal departments.
And was the kind of the city at this time then kind of really booming with all this activity?
Yeah. I think in the first week of after trading began, after this change, you know, and it's actually the other thing that stopped was trading in securities. It used to be done on the floor of the stock exchange, people shouting at each other at prices. And this was the start of on-screen trading. So you could just trade around the world on your screen, which, of course, before was just done on a floor, people shouting. So this was a massive change. And I think in a week after this change, I think the amount of trading in securities went up by 3 times.
Okay, but, so a dramatic increase.
Yeah, within a week, something like that.
And so, like, at this point, you're kind of in your mid-30s, your partner, Alan and Overy, the city is booming, you must have felt pretty good. You're doing a job that you really enjoy, you've got money in your pocket.
Not that much. We weren't paid like they're paid today. No.
But it must have been a fun time.
It was. I mean, it was very interesting. There was so much change going on. And it was like, I measure what was going on a little bit by how much takeover activity there was, because I was doing takeovers then. And it's still a really important part of M&A. And this is what I'm talking about, takeover of listed companies. And I can tell you that, for example, in mid-80s, in the core 2 years, 86, 87, there were, I think, about 500 takeover proposals in the UK of listed companies, fundamentally. 500. If you went to 2020 to 22, there are 143.
Okay.
And that is 500 then compared to 143 now.
So why the big drop?
Well, there are fewer listed companies to take over. The appetite for taking over public companies is a lot less great than it used to be, and there aren't so many to take over. It was just a bit of madness, probably.
Yeah.
So in that sense, I think M&A then was booming, and that was helped by this change in the financing investment bank structure.
And I guess so. The lawyers extremely busy dealing with all these takeovers. Yeah. And I suppose you've been at the takeover panel, so you've got all that expertise. And
that's what I started to use. And when I came back.
Because you hear about a lot of the kind of like the long city lunches in the 80s and those kind of things. I mean, did you have time for those?
I did enjoy a good lunch, I have to say. But no, we don't, even before, as an associate, no, we didn't do big lunches because we didn't have the expense accounts. The only time we ever got a decent lunch was probably after a closing to celebrate. But the brokers and that sort of thing in the early 80s still, in the 70s, I think they were all known for that. There was a long lunch and then you go home or and hopefully you got somebody to drive you rather than anything else. So, but that all stopped after, I think by the end of the 80s, that was much, much less. And there was now an American influence coming in.
Yeah.
You know, Goldman Sachs bought into the stock exchange, it became one of the members, you know, Morgan Stanley, which weren't really there before.
And so the Americans come in and there's this different culture to the Brits.
Yes, yeah, it didn't start to really, I think, you know, became influential slowly because the amount of things, that, but they, you know, they became very important in trading and all sorts of financial areas. But with, and you know, with that did start to become more change, and as, because this is later,
yeah,
American law firms arrived in numbers.
Is that which, more the 90s?
Yeah, right? It is more the 90s, because in this, there were Americans here in the 70s and 80s, but they weren't doing English law.
Yeah.
So they were small. It's rather like the Brits in New York weren't doing New York law then. So they were small, what I call rep offices, which is a bit of an understatement, but yeah, okay. They were small.
And then this was all kind of leading up to the 87 crash.
Yeah.
So what was that like? Just,
well, it was a bit of a, I think it was a bit of a shock for the financial system. I'm not sure how much it affected law firms in terms of reducing work, but I'm not sure about that, to be honest, because there was so much changes going on. People who were probably running the finances of a law firm would know better than I did. And I only went back to my firm, so I was sort of in the panel. I only went back in 88.
Okay.
I was more interested in what was going on in the panel. But that soon recovered. That was a stock market crash, which in 2 years was back to normal. But then that led into the 90s. But there were lots of other things happening that affected lawyers then.
Yeah. And so just on, because we're going to have a chat a little bit about this kind of specifics of things to the legal market and the specific changes to the legal markets. And so you had this sort of wider atmosphere of deregulation in society, and that also that kind of applied to the legal profession too.
Yeah, yes, I suppose it did. Yeah, I think that's a fair comment. The way law firms ran at the beginning of the 80s, I guess, were much smaller, but they grew so much in the 80s. So, and there were partnerships where I think decision making was made, you know, over lunch, and you could meet all your partners quite easily, because there weren't that many in the early 80s in any firm. But by the end of the 80s, the firms had managing partners, quite a new idea. In addition to their senior partners.
So and before they didn't even have a managing partner?
No. It just ran.
Okay.
And they had a few. They didn't have professional. They were the people who did finance and everything. Obviously, they were professional, but you didn't have a finance director who came from a sophisticated background, or HR guy who came from a healthy background, all that sort of stuff. That started to happen at the end of the 80s.
Okay.
That apart, what did start to happen was, you know, lawyers, you know, before 86, they weren't allowed to advertise, for example, market.
Crazy.
They built relationships with clients. Obviously, they went out and they did it personally and everything, but they weren't allowed to really advertise. And competition, I would say, was much more gentlemanly, if you can put it that way.
Yeah.
And I think the way lawyers behaved towards each other started to change in the late 80s.
Okay. When
people were competing. And then in the second half of the 80s, I guess, we had things like Legal 500 and Chambers,
yeah,
with their league table, with their, you know, ranking of lawyers and all, which of course then meant, oh, we need a bit of PR. Very unsophisticated it started as. And then you had the magazines. There was no, before, I can't remember what was the first one, but Legal Business maybe, Legal Week, these all started to appear.
Yeah.
And of course they were challenging what was going on culturally and, you know, a bit scuzzy some of it, you know, if you like. Yeah. But interested in a bit of scandal and a bit of, winding everybody up and to get reactions.
True, and I suppose Legal Cheek is part of that tradition that started all back then.
Yes, I suppose you are.
But underlying that was the lawyers, they wanted publicity because they wanted to start promoting themselves in a more competitive environment.
Yeah, that's what happened, yeah. And that really started then, and of course then built up. And I don't, in one sense, that's what happened, and that's fine, and it's probably a very good thing.
Mm.
But in one sense, it's not a, it brought with it, I think, a watering down of a professional culture to some degree.
Okay.
I think it's only a personal opinion. And
so when you say that professional culture, would you
mean? Like, you would never suggest anything about another firm before this. I mean, I don't remember anybody ever, you know, one law firm or a person as a partner sort of suggesting any criticism of another or saying we're so much better than them.
Okay.
But you know what happened after that was a little bit, it grew and grew and grew, and some people became quite aggressive in that respect.
Sure.
And I do feel there was a little bit of a change there.
Mm.
And there was a big change by as the 80s went into the 90s, the idea of beauty parading and things like that became common, whereas before the business just flowed to partners in law firms, Linklater, Slaughter's, Freshfields, and all the other firms, and they know.
And so these beauty parades, because we've probably got some from our younger listeners, they're probably thinking, beauty parades?
What was it? Ugly
parades.
So this
was like pitching.
Pitching for work.
Pitching for work.
Yes.
To companies.
Yeah, which is now absolutely normal. And became very normal in the 90s. But it started a little bit in the end of the 80s and then grew and grew. And yeah, there was a transaction coming up.
Yeah.
So somebody would ask three firms to pitch for work. And we can talk more about those as they became much more sophisticated later on. And you had to. And a lot of lawyers didn't like all this.
I'm sure.
If you said to a lot of partners the word sales, that wasn't a word that many of them really liked to talk. But that's what a lot of it came to, and you had to start learning sales and how to do it in a nice professional way.
Yeah. And what is the key to that, relationships?
Well, personally, I think, and this has always been the case, that if you're going to be really successful in certainly in the corporate, and actually in most, if you're going to have clients, the relationship that you build is absolutely fundamental to build a long-term business. So I think in the city, what we're talking, that sort of law, it is, the relationships are essential, and you had to now spend much more time on that, whereas before the partners did, or some of them did, and you probably had, in most firms, a small cadre of partners in the beginning of the 80s who were the critical winners of the work, you know.
Yeah.
They got the call. And that all grew and had to grow and grow.
Okay.
In latter years, yeah.
And that's what, you know, just on a bit of a tangent, you were known for that in your career as being a rainmaker, for bringing in a lot of work. So, you mean, you must have been pretty good at sales in your own way.
I think everybody finds their own way of doing it. I had some success, but so did so many partners and partners in other firms. You know, there were loads of people who were good at this. But there's a bit of, and I enjoyed it. I found that was, by the end of my career, that was much more enjoyable than doing transactional business, to be honest. But but I thought it added a new, more exciting thing to do than just sit in the room and argue.
Yeah, so but that is quite a shift, isn't it, in the 80s, from law going from being this kind of profession where it's like you're not even allowed to emphasize and sales is a dirty word, to the end of the decade.
Yeah, and beyond. It took a while for it to really become accepted this was the reality.
But I suppose that's very kind of as well, kind of Thatcher's 80s too, isn't it?
I think that's fairly true.
And so other developments for the legal profession at that time?
Well, you had things that happened, like the Clifford Chance was created, which was a big event, Coward Chance merging with Clifford Turner to one finance firm, one a corporate, and they created this big outfit.
Was that the first big law firm merger?
Yeah. That I think made people sit up. Things were changing. I think the career path thing, as I say, in-house was now growing. You know, it wasn't anything like it has become, which I think is marvellous in terms of opportunity. I think knowledge management became a much more significant thing from late 80s, grew and grew through the 90s. And how you spread knowledge through a firm. One of the things I mentioned earlier, I think, was you didn't get much training. Well, there wasn't also the way of communicating through laptops and, you know, the internet. If you want to communicate knowledge, you either went to a lecture or somebody distributed a note in physical form, and there was no other way of doing it.
Yeah.
So, you know, or you went and read a book. That's, people realised, God, we needed to get everybody up to sharing the knowledge of the firm, getting it out into everybody's minds, as opposed to today, just each person knew what they knew. What you wanted them to know was what everybody else knew.
Yeah. And that's still a challenge. When you're smaller, you can kind of operate like that, can't you? And you become bigger and it's just not possible.
No, absolutely correct. Yeah.
But it's probably a good time to kind of segue into sort of the difference with some of the sort of technology, because that kind of touches on it. And so, you know, going back to when you started out, I mean, there's no computers on the desk. Well, there's no
No. You're lucky. A quill pen.
You got a pen and you've got a pad of paper.
Yeah, that's right.
In fact, you have your own phone, right?
Oh, yeah, phone was critical, yeah.
So phone, pen and that even that's, I mean, that's strange to think of a desk without a computer.
Of course, hard for people to imagine now, and perhaps hard for people to imagine what it's going to be like in 20 years' time. I have no idea. But I think it's fair to say when I started, the methods of communicating were phone, post, pretty important, by hand delivery. They had in the city, there was you either took it yourself or you could use the document exchange. There was this was a sort of private thing within London. Well, there was telex. I won't explain what telex was, but it was basically words on a sort of like a toilet roll coming off of a machine. And it was like if you wanted to amend something, say.
Yeah.
You say, I wanted to delete the word "and." So that would be done by not sending a document with a thing in it. Your telex would come and say, in paragraph so-and-so, in line so-and-so, just before the word "blob," in quotes, delete "and," unquote. And that's all just to do a slight amendment. And these toilet rolls would come off this machine, hopeless. But fax came, and fax revolutionised communication.
Okay.
Because you didn't now have to deliver on a motorbike all the documents.
Yeah.
You could now fax them.
Okay. But, I mean, even now, faxes seem very inefficient, and the telex seems just like insanely inefficient.
Well, it was what there was. So
the change in communications is
a massive thing.
So much.
Yeah, that was massive.
Did working in that way? Were there some advantages though? Because you had a bit more space.
Yes.
And you had
the classic thing was, if you were doing a transaction with a document of 20 pages then rather than 120 or whatever it might be, if you wanted to change it, the early 80s, if you wanted to change it, you couldn't just put it in and change it and send it off. So what you did was you marked it up in, say, blue. You wrote in blue your changes. And then you sent it to Linklaters or whoever it was. And they sent it back to you with their comments in red. This was called a travelling draft. And it travelled and travelled until we got to a point where, we've agreed some stuff, let's have a new one. And that was a big exercise to retype it. So, or word processing came, and word processing made it a bit quicker. But so it didn't mean you changing things was precious. You didn't just do it for the hell of it. You had to have a good reason.
Yeah.
Because the consequences were considerable. So, yeah, very, very different. But you know, once fax came, then you had phone fax posted by hand. And then, well, now we know what we've got, and that maybe that's another wider topic.
And do you remember when, I mean, presumably it was into the 90s when you would have first got a computer on your desk?
No, I don't think we, at the beginning, yeah, it would have been in the 90s, but I don't think it was the early 90s. Okay, I can't quite place it. I'd have to do a bit of research, but I'm not quite sure.
But very, very different. And I suppose maybe another advantage was you didn't have so many documents. As you said, like, you treated the documents you had with a bit more, kind of treasured them a bit more because of the difficulties.
Yeah, because they were hard to...
I suppose one of the things that these days trainees have problems with is just so much many documents and emails and communication. And,
it's just... Yes, totally. People are swamped, aren't they? I mean, that's one of the things when I think... email and everything came in, it just happened and everybody did it in their own way. Mm. You know, they started to use all these things and there were no protocols that how to control it and so what you have ended up with was an almighty mess of email in a way. But anyway, I'm not being critical, it's just the way life worked.
To kind of get towards wrapping up, I think we've been going for about an hour, which is great. There's no time limit, but I just wanted to ask you what I want to kind of do after 97 and just into after 87 and into the early 90s recession. But also, one thing you mentioned that I wanted to ask you was about Canary Wharf, because that was one of the developments.
Yes, yeah.
So that was being built, and I don't, you know, it's in the news. Well, it's been, I don't know if people have watched the drama on BBC Gold, because it's talking about the Brinks map bullion robbery, which was in 1982, and some of that gold went into, was laundered, and it was into building bits of Canary Wharf.
Oh, right, I missed that. I enjoyed the series, but I missed that bit.
They didn't cover it in detail. A bit of a tenuous link from me there, but... What was going on there? Was that a symptom of Canary Wharf being like the city expanding and there's just not enough room here? And this is such a booming sector that we need more space.
Yeah, I think it was kind of a visionary thing for, because it was a Canadian who started Canary Wharf. I can't remember the names now, but we can come back to that. They started it, and I think it was quite a visionary thing to have a second financial. And of course, it would be built from scratch, so you'd have the most modern kit, the most modern everything, as opposed to in the city. Everybody was at different stages of renovation. Mm. But of course, the city has been rebuilt really since then. Yeah. And Canary Wharf, I think it got occupied, original tenants, people like Morgan Stanley, probably Credit Suisse, and people like that. And it was a marvellous, but of course, it was financed. And of course, one minute it was the wonder of Canary Wharf, and then in 93 was it bust?
Yeah,
I think. And that's actually probably in the 93 bit, again another massive area of business, but which did have a big effect on law firms negatively.
Yeah,
was of course business slowed down generally, and we were into reconstruction of a lot of companies went bust.
Yeah.
And Canary Wharf was perhaps one of the biggest examples. And here you've got the equivalent to privatisation work, or bigger than buyout work was reconstruction work.
Okay.
Where, the receiver or whoever was appointed, lawyers pour in, due diligence gone mad. And here was another thing which was huge for those firms that were in that business.
And more activity for lawyers.
Oh, a terrific firm. I mean, if you look at life that way, yeah. But again, not doing most of them not doing necessarily the most exciting things.
Yeah.
And of course, these things, you mentioned Lehman.
Yeah.
But these went on for a long, long time.
Yeah.
Employing lots of people. But not all firms were in it.
Yeah.
And if other business dropped off, and this was a period when I think you started to lose some of the old names in the late 80s, early 90s, and so on. Some of the old names who were well-known corporate firms in London,
yeah.
I won't name them, started to disappear or come under pressure, and they started to merge with other firms.
Oh, that's interesting. So yeah. So there was the 87 crash, but that's just a stock market crash. It bounced back.
Bounced back from that.
And then you didn't get the recession kind of came in 1989.
Yeah, through to 93, I suppose. And then,
But it was around that period then some of the law firms...
I think started to struggle.
And why? I mean...
Because I think, you know, with business, their clients, if it depends who your clients were, I'm sure that the biggest firms, I think they had such a good client base, and in law firms do really well in very good times and very bad times, and they always do very well. But in very bad times, the sort of balance of the business tends to change, and it goes from lots of necessarily perhaps the lovely M&A and all the international, more exciting stuff. You get more litigation. Everybody looks to who's to blame. So lots of stuff has to be looked into. You get investigations. Huge numbers of people in the legal profession used for investigations. And you get reconstructions.
Yeah.
And if they get big businesses going bust, then there's an awful lot of legal work for each one of those. And I think some firms did very well out of that, and others didn't participate that much.
Okay. Well, they were just a bit...
didn't have the skills.
They didn't have the...
Because it's quite a special, you know, the insolvency type work was regarded as a bit of a speciality, and it was a speciality.
Okay. But so that it was that they needed to have... They just unlucky, or they should have recruited people.
Well, you can argue. I'd argue it's a bit of luck, probably. Yeah. You know, again, you know, the way life happens is just sometimes you make good decisions, and maybe some made bad decisions. I don't know.
But it was the firms with a kind of cross practice area speciality that did well. Did you kind of get rebadged then as a kind of corporate / finance lawyer?
I was doing less personally. I did less of the M&A, which I liked doing.
Yeah.
But there was always buying stuff out of insolvency, and some corporate lawyers were always involved in that, as well as finance lawyers.
Yeah.
So yeah, you had to do a bit more of that, but again, the principles of what you're doing were much the same as when life was normal.
Mm.
Yeah. So but a lot of people learnt new skills, and so you know, which is a good thing.
So that kind of takes us on the journey of this podcast from 1978 through to 1993, and I mean, some of the changes in that time are really quite dramatic.
Yeah, they certainly are, and I think you'll find too that you know that lawyers now, you've got the in-house lawyers starting, and particularly in the city, there are much more lawyers being employed in banks and so on, that's starting, and that's a good thing for the legal profession.
Yeah.
It gives different choices, so that was a plus. I think culture in law firms was changing, and as partnerships grew, they became more corporate, and there's more of that to come, of course, and in the 90s.
Yeah, and that sets us up, for our next episode, which is focusing on the 90s from 93 right through until into the new millennium, and, you know, ending with the Lehman crash in 2008. But we're not going to cover that today, but do tune in for another episode of this podcast where we're going to be hearing all about that period. But it's been fascinating speaking about, you know, hearing that that shift that took place in that time, and thank you so much for sharing your recollections with us.
Well, thank you for having me, and as I say, this is my take on things. Others may disagree, but that's always the case with people's different experiences. So thank you for having me.
Thank you.